and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the difficulty President Trump is having getting competent lawyers to represent him as he finds himself following the resignation of John Dowd and the unhiring of Joseph DeGeneva, represented by only one personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow, a religious right commentator who has crusaded for evangelical causes and so-called religious freedom. Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office, joins us to discuss how Trump's legal team is getting weaker while it appears that the case Robert Mueller is building against the president is getting stronger, not to mention how Trump's private lawyer Michael Cohen is being crushed by Stormy Daniels' lawyer. We will assess the status of the Mueller inquiry and whether the findings will ever see the light of day, as well as what might result from a high-profile indictment of, say, Jared Kushner. Would that be sufficiently damaging to Trump to either provoke him to move against Mueller or be sufficient to cause the Republicans to distance themselves from Trump ahead of the November elections? Then, with an Uber hawk who wants to bomb Iran about to become Trump's national security advisor, we will examine what a war against Iran would look like with a longtime scholar of Iran, William Beeman, chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. He served as a consultant to the State Department, the Defense Department, the UN, and the Congress, and is the author of The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and joins us to discuss how Trump will tear up the treaty with Iran while Bolton will push for America to fight a war against Iran at the behest of Israel's Netanyahu and Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman. Then finally, following last night's 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels and the recent apology to Melania Trump on CNN by a Playboy model who had an affair with Trump, we will speak with Kate Anderson Brower, a CNN contributor and the author of The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House, and First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. We will discuss her latest article at CNN, What Melania Now Has in Common with Hillary, and whether the current First Lady will continue the tradition of presidential spouses standing by their man. And joining us now is Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University, who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States, and she also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Kern Griffin.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Lisa. And let's just touch on Trump's legal team. It seems now he's down to only one personal lawyer, Jay Sekulow. His lawyer quit the other day. Then he tried to hire DeGeneva, a U.S. attorney, a former U.S. attorney with somewhat controversial views, shall we say. And I don't know what happened there with him and his wife, but he's back down from that. So there seems to be a certain amount of disarray, even though Ty Cobb, who's representing the White House, seems to be still pretty consistent. But Dowd apparently quit over Trump's apparently insistence that he can handle Mueller when most of his legal advisors don't think that's a good idea. So at this point, what's your take on what seems to be, by the way, it also seems to be reflected in the other case of the Stormy Daniels case, where it looks like Trump's private lawyer, Cohen, is being out-lawyered, if you will, by Stormy Daniels' lawyer. So does he have a legal deficiency, shall we say?
Oh, I think he does. I think it's a quite extraordinary situation where the President of the United States is all but representing himself in what may be the most significant criminal investigation in recent history.
And is this because of his personality, his mercurial personality? What's your understanding? Or is he just a cheapskate? Or is it the other possibility that the big white shoe law firms have no one having to do with him?
Well, there are a number of reasons why the usual suspects would not want to get involved in this case. I think that the president is a notoriously difficult and stubborn client, and that doesn't always augur well for the outcome of a case. there are some ethical constraints on what the best lawyers would want to get involved with in terms of what they might be asked to do or be put in a position of having to do. There are some conflicts issues given how many tentacles this investigation has and how many other people have Washington representation in the case. And early on, there were some suggestions that some of it was financial as well. I think at this point, the biggest difficulty is the cast of characters that surrounds the president and the very difficult nature of his personality and how hard it is to represent him.
Well, of course, the political opposition in this country, many, I think, are expecting a blue wave, and they're also invested in impeachment. There are a bunch of ads being put out by a California billionaire to that effect. And it seems to me that there's an element of wishful thinking here, and that at the end of the day, people, I don't think, are clear about what the Mueller mandate is, that somehow, perhaps because of Ken Starr, they think that there's a special counsel statute still operating, when my understanding is at the end of the day, we may not even see a Mueller report. There's no obligation to make it public, from what I understand.
So Mr. Mueller is operating under the special counsel regulations, but he is not operating under the independent counsel statute that governed at the time of, for example, the Ken Starr investigation into President Clinton's conduct. So it is a different situation. Ken Starr was operating independently. He took full advantage of his ability to release a report to the public. It was a salacious bestseller of a report that dropped like an album at the end of his investigation. And that is not the situation that Mr. Mueller is in. He has supervisors within the Department of Justice because he is operating under a different law and under a set of regulations known as the special counsel regulations. And he, at the moment, reports to Rod Rosenstein, who is the deputy attorney general. So whatever happens to the report in the Mueller investigation is going to be largely up to the discretion of the deputy attorney general.
So what should the public expect here, particularly those, as I mentioned, that might have an investment in impeachment or some kind of removal, because clearly Donald Trump is not our most popular president?
Well, 2 points about that. I think that it's important to understand that impeachment is basically the functional equivalent of an indictment. It's only an opening bid. In order for the president to actually be removed, he has to be convicted by the Senate. And that is not going to happen. Even if there is a blue wave of sorts in the 2018 midterms, that's at this point much more likely to affect the House than the Senate. And even if it were to affect the Senate, it would be by the slimmest of margins and not a big enough one to ensure the president's conviction in the Senate. So while I do think there is a chance of him being impeached in the sense that the House would pass articles of impeachment, I think there is no chance at all of the president being removed because he is convicted by the Senate, unless, of course, very serious underlying criminality is revealed somehow through the Mueller investigation. If and when the president leaves the White House before 2020, I think it's likely to be because his back is against the wall and he resigns in exchange for some favorable treatment, like a pardon, in much the same way that Richard Nixon did. On your question about the report, I understand that it is frustrating to imagine Mueller having completed this investigation and then not releasing something that is available to the public or even maybe to Congress itself. But it is functionally up to Rod Rosenstein, although there are a variety of ways that this could play out. He will submit his full report to the Justice Department. That report will include material that must remain secret. Some of it will be classified. Some of it will be grand jury material that it can't be revealed under the regulations that govern the grand jury. He could also give the Justice Department a second version of the report that does not include material that has to be kept secret, and that might be released to Congress, and it might even be released to the public, depending on what Rod Rosenstein decides to do and what the pressures on him are at that particular point in time. Even if the report never sees the light of day, though, we're starting to see just the tip of the iceberg, the beginning of what the Mueller investigation has uncovered in the indictments, in the court documents themselves. And I believe there will be additional indictments, and I believe that with each indictment, a fuller version of the story will come out. So through these speaking indictments, at least some of what the investigation has revealed will eventually become known to the public.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University, who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States and also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. So that, I guess, is where I think, well, first of all, it's apparent that something is really bothering President Trump. And I get a lot of solicitations from conservative groups and think tanks, etc. And there's a drumbeat to fire Mueller, as earlier there was a drumbeat to release the Nunes memo. And it feels like this is a kind of orchestrated campaign. And certainly for the first time ever, Trump has been tweeting out direct attacks on Robert Mueller, which hadn't happened previously. So my sense is that, well, let me ask you, what's your hunch about what it is that Trump is so afraid of?
I imagine that there is underlying wrongdoing, and both involving the campaign and, of course, involving his financial dealings with the Russians and others going back 2 years before the campaign. So there's no doubt that he fears revelations that will be very damaging to him. Whether or not those will come out, of course, remains to be seen. But as many people have noted, his behavior is not the behavior of someone who has nothing to conceal and no fear of the investigation. I don't think that necessarily means that the best strategic move for him is to try to precipitate the termination of Robert Mueller. He would have to fire not only Robert Mueller, but pretty much everyone involved in the investigation. He would have to persuade the Department of Justice to dismiss the pending suits. There are already quite a few people who have been indicted, have pled guilty, are awaiting sentencing. So it is hard to call something fake news when it is happening in real courts. And he would have to do away not only with the people involved, but also with the cases that are pending. It's not inconceivable to me that he would do that, but it would take a series of very aggressive moves for him to make this entire investigation go away, including probably issuing some pardons. And at that point, I think we will be witnessing a president who has reverted to a complete scorched earth strategy in dealing with the pressures on him. I don't think we're at that point yet. I think the president acts at all times and in every way in his own self-interest, and he will probably play out this string until he imagines that the peril he will be in by trying to do away with the Mueller investigation is less than the peril that he is in by letting it continue. At the moment, I think he probably still has at least some vague hope that the investigation will conclude without serious wrongdoing about him being revealed. And as long as he has that hope, I imagine that he'll forego firing the special counsel only because it will be so politically perilous for him to do so.
Well, Politico is reporting that the Trump people are very concerned about Rick Gates telling all to Mueller. As you know, he has is cooperating. And he may well be, at least according to the Politico article, more important than even Michael Flynn. And he certainly, in terms of whatever they have on Manafort or whatever case they're building against him, he will obviously have a lot to say about that. But at the heart of Manafort, what seems to be pretty straightforward here, and this, I wonder whether this is what also applies to Trump. Manafort essentially was given $30 million by an oligarch close to Putin who was also close to organized crime. And then he sort of started to call the debt. Apparently, Manafort just squandered the money. We don't know what he did with it, but the money disappeared. And then Manafort got the job as campaign director without a payment. Then he was able to get Deripaska off his back by saying, you know, we'll give you private briefings. And we know that the Republican platform was changed to make it more Russia-friendly. So Deripaska completely switched his tune as long as Manafort was in there. And the minute that Manafort got fired, then Deripaska sues him for recovering, I think, $20 million of the missing $30 million. Could that same pattern be also applied to Donald Trump in terms of raising money from dubious Russians who you just simply don't want them to be your creditors?
I think that the various Russians, including potentially even the Russian government itself, probably have compromising information and some financial leverage that is meaningful to the president. He, of course, himself, though, is in a very powerful position and can, in some respects, counteract that leverage. Of course, Paul Manafort wanted to monetize his involvement in the campaign and wasn't really able to do so and is now in a very vulnerable position. And so there's some question whether the special counsel indictment or his situation with respect to his Russian creditors is more serious. But he's in a very different position than the president. I don't know that the president is going to be put in such a vulnerable position in the short term. In the long term, who knows? This story is it gets stranger every day, and I have no prediction about the president's status with respect to his Russian creditors when and if his presidency comes to a precipitous end.
So back to your analysis, Lisa Kern Griffin, of how we're learning about what Mueller might be up to, because the report may not come out, or who knows when it will come out. But in the meantime, we get a glimpse into what he's working on from the indictments, and they do seem to be fairly well written, to say the least. So is that to say then that those, particularly on the Democratic side, that are depending upon Mueller or impeachment or whatever, what's going to happen before the election? I mean, in other words, since the report's not likely to be out possibly for a year or so, from what I understand, maybe you have better information than me, but the long and the short of it is that I think that what it would take, I think, would be something like an indictment of Jared Kushner to really get the attention of President Trump and of the Republicans who seem to be backing him or enabling him.
Well, first of all, I don't think anyone's information about this is better than anyone else's. One of the things that has been so admirable about the special counsel's investigation is that it is very buttoned down and leak-free, and it is an extremely professional operation, and we are all speculating based on what we learn from what they do in court, which is the only place where they've done their talking. They don't speak to the press. They do their speaking through court documents and court appearances. So we're all speculating based on what we see in court and what we've observed in similar investigations over time. But it is always just a prediction until they actually act, and they've done a masterful job of holding their cards very close to the vest. I think that because the special counsel is such a consummate professional and such a long-time DOJ professional, that he will likely follow the Justice Department's guidelines on whether or not to take dramatic action in an investigation in a time period that is very close to an election. The letter issued by Director Comey notwithstanding, it has always been Justice Department policy to try to keep those things separate. And I would be very surprised if the special counsel were issuing indictments right up until the election or in the months right before the election. So if there are further steps to be taken in the near term in the investigation, I suspect that they will be late spring, early summer, and that there may be a lull after that in order to allow the electoral process to play out. That is, of course, assuming that there isn't some criminality that is very important to reveal at a particular point in time or some climax in the investigation that just can't be avoided. Sometimes that happens. But generally speaking, I think he will lay low during the actual sort of late summer, early fall electoral period. I don't know when the report will come out, and we may not know that it has come out because, of course, it will go, as I said, first to the Justice Department and, at the moment, to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein.
It does seem, though, that Donald Trump is using the playbook from his mentor, Roy Cohn, in terms of going after your accuser in a slash-and-burn, take-no-prisoners way. But the collateral damage so far seems to be the Justice Department itself and the FBI. And since you were a federal prosecutor, Lisa Kern Griffin, what's your understanding of what's happening to the morale within both those organizations? The Attorney General himself has not come to the support of his rank and file. He obviously hung Andrew McCabe out to dry, if not directly fired him on Trump's orders. Do you have any inkling of how the morale is inside the DOJ and the FBI?
I don't, because I'm not within those organizations at the moment. I can imagine that it's regarded as very damaging to have the chief executive critiquing the investigative agents These are elite organizations. They are staffed by consummate professionals. They, generally speaking, operate entirely separate from partisan influence. To the extent that FBI agents have any identifiable political leanings, they are notably to the right. And that's entirely beside the point, though, and doesn't affect the way in which they go about enforcing the laws of this country. So I think to suggest otherwise is very damaging, undermines the entire rule of law. And I think that it will have lasting repercussions. I think there will be a long, hopefully successful repair period after this presidency is over. And I think that at this point, the professionals in those departments are probably very much looking forward to that.
But just in closing, so far, Donald Trump has definitely attacked his accusers, and he's been successful, has he not, firing Comey, McCabe, and others within the DOJ who have been marginalized or sent to Siberia or essentially, you know, attacked.
Yes, he has so far gotten away with it. He seems to be able to act with impunity. The Republican leadership in Congress has done nothing to check his abuses of power, and it's unclear whether they will at any point. So he certainly keeps testing the waters, and that has led some people to speculate that he's gearing up to terminate the special counsel. I think he's focused, frankly, far more on discrediting the special counsel rather than go to the trouble of firing him. I think he's trying to ensure that whatever findings he eventually releases are irrelevant to the 40% base on which the president relies, and maybe even to the Republican leadership in Congress.
Well, Lisa Kern Griffin, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Kern Griffin, who's a professor of law at Duke University, who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the United States Supreme Court and also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. We're going to take a brief station break and look into what a war with Iran would look like now that we have an Uber hawk who wants to bomb Iran about to become Trump's National Security Advisor.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, yeah. Watch it.
Just sit there, facing the hill. Just say, who gonna take away his license to kill? Now he's helping for destruction. He's afraid and confused, and his brain has been mismanaged with great
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is William Beaman, a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. Best known as a Middle East specialist for more than 30 years, he served as a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress, and is the author of 14 books, including Language, Status, and Power in Iran, The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Beaman.
Thank you so much.
And with John Bolton about to be the National Security Advisor, the closest and perhaps the most important person outside of the President of the United States on this planet, since he's at the apex of all the information that comes in and adjudicates between state and defense and all of the other government departments, this is an enormously powerful position for somebody that is widely seen as a hawk, if not a warmonger. He's already made it clear, as the president has, that he doesn't want to renew the Iran deal. Let's start with that. What do you think the consequences are? Because as far as I can tell, the P5+1 agreement was not just with the United States. It was with all of the permanent members of the UN Security Council, along with Germany. So this seems to be more like something that's going to disrupt our relationships with our allies as opposed to punish Iran?
Well, there's no question that President Trump and John Bolton are utterly ignoring the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran deal. I doubt that they read it because it is a very comprehensive, multinational plan with regard to Iran. And it's not possible, really, for one nation to withdraw from the agreement. What the United States can do is to refuse to uphold the agreement and by carrying out actions that are that the United States has already guaranteed to carry out. So what it would mean is that the United States is not tearing up the treaty or destroying the treaty. What the United States is doing is reneging on the treaty. So it's failing to it would be failing to undertake its duties under the treaty, and this signals to Europe and also to the world that the United States can't be trusted. That when we have an agreement, that we're not willing to stand by it. So I think that this is on purely diplomatic grounds. This is a disastrous. This would be a disastrous move. But President Trump doesn't seem to really understand this. He somehow believes that this agreement is a transactional agreement between Iran and the United States solely. This is a misperception on his part. And I think that it is yet another indication of the utter incompetence of the Trump administration with regard to foreign relations.
Yeah, and I imagine it's going to impact the possibility of a summit with the North Korean, because I don't know why Kim Jong-un would bother to meet with somebody that breaks treaties. But we'll see what happens there.
Well, let me point out something else, and that is that the United States and Iran are also signatories to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty of 1970. There are about 200 nations in the world, with the exception of Israel, Pakistan, India, North Korea, and also South Sudan, are signatories to this agreement. And this agreement, this prohibits any nation from actually pursuing atomic or nuclear weapons, except for those who already had them at the time of the treaty. And that's the United States, Great Britain, France, China, and Russia. So we already have a treaty in existence that would prohibit Iran from ever having a nuclear weapon, unless they withdrew from that treaty, and they have no intention of doing it. So the United States also is prohibited from promulgating any kind of nuclear weapons technology to any other country. Also, the United States is required to reduce its nuclear arsenal, as are all members of the who are signatories to the treaty. So President Trump, who wants to increase the United States nuclear arsenal, is also violating that treaty. So we're in a situation where actually nothing that we have with regard to nuclear technology is being observed by the Trump administration. They're ignoring everything.
So, William Beaman, a lot of people think that we're on a path to war with having a warmonger essentially as the National Security Advisor, and a president who is quite belligerent and very insecure. He obviously doesn't know what he's doing, and he's subject to the advice of people, particularly those that gave him money. Among his biggest donors is Sheldon Adelson, who apparently brokered the deal to get Bolton on board. Adelson, of course, is close to Netanyahu, and it would seem that that's a part of the agenda. And Netanyahu also has been quite zealous in terms of taking on Iran, as has the new Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, MBS. But the bottom line is here that both the Saudis and the Israelis want the Americans to go to war on their behest. So American boys
yes,
and girls
right. Exactly. The Saudis and the Israelis have declared, or it's really not the Israelis per se, it's actually Benjamin Netanyahu. And it's not the Saudis per se, it's actually Mohammed bin Salman, MBS. So I just came back from Saudi Arabia. I was there for a month, well, twice actually, in December and January. I had a chance to talk to many, many Saudis. I speak Arabic. And their perception of the situation was puzzlement. They couldn't understand why Mohammed bin Salman was attacking Iran. They just couldn't figure it out. They know about the war in Yemen. They know that there are some that there are also some Shia Muslims in Saudi Arabia who are restive. But Saudis have vacationed in Iran for quite some time, especially in the city of Shiraz. There are many people in the Gulf region and on the Arabian Peninsula who are of Iranian extraction. And so their puzzlement as to why their government was pursuing this course was very, very evident to me. With regard to Israel, the last four directors of Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, so to speak, have publicly declared that Iran is not an existential danger to Israel. So we have two leaders, Mohammed bin Salman and Benjamin Netanyahu, who are pursuing a war strategy with regard to Iran, and their own countries largely don't agree with them, and they want the United States to do the work. They want the United States to actually carry out the military action. So, quite aside from, you know, the virtue of attacking Iran or whether Iran deserves it or not, the United States is really behaving in an extremely foolish way. We're falling into a situation where we have two powers that are far inferior to the United States in terms of their military abilities and capabilities. Who are essentially directing the United States to do something on their behalf that we have really no strategic reason to do. Iran has never hurt the United States in any way. There were no Iranians involved in the 9/11 attacks. There have been no Iranian terrorists who have been active against the United States. There's just simply nothing. Not only that, Iran never had, as far as we know, doesn't have today and will not have any nuclear weapons program. There's no evidence to support that conclusion. But it still is promulgated by Netanyahu, by MBS, and also by the hawks in the Trump administration.
And again, I'm speaking with William Beeman, a professor, chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. He's been a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress, and is the author of The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other, and his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. But when you say that Iranians have never done anything against the United States, I mean, what about Mughniyeh? What about blowing up the embassies in Beirut and the U.S. Marines? He was operated by IRGC and Quds, was he not?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no proof that that actually happened.
What? This actually
predates the establishment of the Quds in Iran. We can't get our history mixed up here. The Hezbollah, which is now the major political party in Lebanon, was founded in 1980, and admittedly, it was founded with the help of Iran, who saw Hezbollah as a defense force for the disadvantaged Shia population of Lebanon, who were not being defended by their own government. So anything previous to 1980 is not doesn't have anything to do with Iran or the Quds Force or anything. So the other claims that Iran was somehow involved in the bombing of things in Kenya or Tanzania or Argentina, there's absolutely no proof that Iran had any involvement in any of those things. So these are charges that have been laid out by people who really do want to be hostile to Iran, and their hostility really dates from the embassy occupation during the Iranian Revolution in 1979. We have people who are still extremely angry about that, and they don't feel that Iran ever paid an adequate price for the embassy occupation. And that's the root, really, of all of the hostility on the part of Americans toward Iran.
Well, I don't know who did those bombings that you mentioned. There's a significant amount of attacks around the world. But what about Friday prayers? I mean, your book was The Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs. I mean, U.S. has been the Great Satan. As far as I can tell, the government of Iran is not particularly popular with its own citizens. And I'm not talking about the actual government. I'm talking about the real power, which is the supreme leader, the IRGC, etc. The young and the educated seem to be quite alienated. I mean, my sense is that the most catastrophic thing of all is that we have crazy people in our government about to go to war against a government that has spent, at least a power structure that spent all of its time talking about this, and it would do nothing but destroy any possibilities of Iran entering the world community and ending its isolation, but rather play right into the hands of the hardliners in Iran.
Well, it's certainly true that the government of Iran has used the United States as a foil. And that was actually the crux of my book. When we talk about the Great Satan versus the Mad Mullahs, we have Iranians, especially Iranian leadership, calling the United States the Great Satan and enumerating the many, many crimes of the United States, which, by the way, are actual crimes against Iran. It's not that the United States is totally innocent and never did anything to harm Iranians. There's a litany, a long list of hostilities that were directed toward Iran on the part of the United States. And I think that if the embassy occupation is the most important one for Americans, the overthrow of the Iranian government in 1952 to reinstall the Shah of Iran by the American CIA and British M6 is the point in Iranian history where Iranians began to decide that the United States was going to be totally hostile toward Iran. After the hostage crisis, by the way, the United States signed the Algiers Accords with Iran to settle the matter of the hostages. The Algiers Accords guarantee that the United States will never interfere in Iranian internal affairs. And the United States right now, John Bolton, and during the Bush administration, people calling for regime change in Iran, openly calling for that. That was a stated policy during the Bush administration, and it will be a stated policy again when John Bolton is in office. That is clearly in violation of the Algiers Accords. The United States should not be, and promised not to, interfere in Iran's internal affairs. John Bolton, six, seven months ago, met with a terrorist organization, the Mujahideen-e-Khalq, in Europe. The Mujahideen have been fighting against the Iranian revolutionary government since the time of the revolution. They are communists. They are so-called Islamic communists. They are hated by the Iranian population. But they have the fantasy that they are going to overthrow the government of Iran and install themselves as leaders of the country. We've had many American right-wing politicians who have embraced the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Sam Brownback, when he was a senator in Washington, actually gave them a spot in his office in Washington. John Bolton has told them that the United States is going to support their cause. Is going to support the overthrow of the government of Iran on behalf of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq. Now, this is something that the U.S. citizens should be extremely unhappy about, and realize that there's a tremendous danger here. This is John Bolton supporting open terrorist revolutionaries in order to try to get the Iranian government overthrown in violation of every arrangement, every treaty, every agreement we've ever had with Iran.
And, of course, Bolton's been taking money from the MEC for a long time. But let's just, in the last minute, I wanted to get your appraisal of what would happen if the United States went to war with Iran. They've obviously got the assets because this regime in the White House has ties to this Betsy DeVos's brother who's in the Emirates, the mercenary army founder, Eric Prince. There's also this other sleazy guy that the New York Times has been...
George Nader,
the child abuser and child pornographer, along with his his buddy who's being exposed in there, who's got a military contractor. These are the mischief makers.
Brody, right?
Yeah, they could. They have the means to start to spark a conflict, maybe with the IRGC speedboats and close down the Straits of Hormuz, do whatever. It makes no sense, of course, to cut off the oil flow out of the Gulf. Obviously, the Russians would do very well out of a rise in the price of oil. I'm sure Putin would not be that distressed by his ally being attacked if it meant that he could have a huge windfall. But at the end of the day, I'd see nothing but catastrophe all around. And Iran is not, you know, that's not like Iraq. This is a serious country, very patriotic people. And they will fight the U.S.
Yes, there's no question that John Bolton, I'll tell you already that the specter of John Bolton coming into this position, which, by the way, is not a position that needs confirmation by the Senate. He just is appointed and he takes office immediately. A lot of Americans think that the Senate would have confirmation hearings for John Bolton. They will not. What will happen is he has to pass a security check, and I'm wondering about whether he'd be able to do that. But but he'll immediately take office, and I think that putting him in that position rather than, let's say, Secretary of Defense or something like that was a way to bypass Congress, who already rejected John Bolton for UN ambassador during the Bush administration. There are serious concerns about this man. And in Iran, already last week, we already have the hardliners in Iran touting the appointment of John Bolton as yet another example of the United States planning to direct hostilities toward Iran, and warning the Iranian population that these overtures to the West by President Rouhani have really, this is what we've come to as a result of that, that the Iranians have gone soft, that they're not going to be able to defend themselves, and so therefore we have to essentially support the hardliners and stop all of this social engineering and the soft stuff that Rouhani is projecting. So essentially, for Bolton to come on, it worsens the situation with regard to Iran and the United States. It almost guarantees that there will be no rapprochement.
Well, but I wanted to get your analysis very quickly of what a war would involve, because that seems to be where we're heading.
Sure. First of all, Iran has 10 times the troop strength of, for instance, Saudi Arabia. Even though Saudi Arabia spends 10 times as much on military equipment as Iran. But they don't have people to actually fight such a war. Iran is a huge country. It is the size of the entire western part of the United States. It has 74 million people, and most of them are young people. So there are literally millions of potential troops that could be marshaled in order to fight a war. With anybody, with the United States or with anybody. Right. We were mired in Iraq for years, and it cost us billions of dollars. If we were to start a war with Iran, it would probably last decades, and the United States would likely lose. Now, it's possible the Israelis might come in, the Saudis might come in, but Iran has enormous resources. During this period of time, Iran has become self-sufficient in just about everything that you could imagine, except for very highly specialized technological equipment. Iran manufactures its own steel, it manufactures its own cars, it manufactures its own weapons. There is no need for anybody to supply anything from outside of the country. That said, they're still going to get supplies from Russia. They're going to be supplied by China. So the United States is really the idea of engaging in a war with Iran is a ridiculous proposition. If the U.S. thought that they were going to go in and out of Iraq in 6 months, which is what Dick Cheney thought. They're sadly mistaken if they think that they could drop a few bombs on Iran and have the government fold, which is something in the Bush administration they thought they were going to do, or that they could bring Iran to its knees in a very, very short period of time. This is extremely foolish. That's not to say that we haven't seen foolish things already from the Trump administration, but this would be a cataclysmic disaster, and the United States should not go there.
I thank you for joining us, William Beaman.
You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with William Beaman. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Minnesota and the president of the Middle East section of the American Anthropological Association. He's been a consultant to the United States State Department, the Department of Defense, the United Nations, and the United States Congress. And he's the author of The Great Satan Versus the Mad Mullahs, How the United States and Iran Demonize Each Other. And his latest book is Iranian Performance Traditions. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into whether, following last night's 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels, the current First Lady Melania Trump will continue the tradition of presidential spouses standing by their man.
That until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Cause after all, he's just a man. Something warm to come to when nights are cold and lonely.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Kate Anderson Brower, a CNN contributor and the author of The Residence, Inside the Private World of the White House and First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. Her latest article at CNN is What Melania Now Has in Common with Hillary. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Anderson Brower.
Thanks for having me.
And what was your impression of the 60 Minutes interview with Stormy Daniels? It seemed a little underwhelming. I imagine those that thought somehow she'd be delivering a knockout blow to Donald Trump might have been disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that most people don't have any illusions about Donald Trump necessarily going into this. I mean, the idea of him as a fully devoted husband and father is not something that most people would believe to necessarily be true. And so it wasn't that surprising. And you're right. I think the interview was a little bit anticlimactic last night. But I think the broader question about Melania Trump and what she's going to do, I think it's very, I mean, it's humiliating. It would be humiliating for any woman in the spotlight to hear those things about your husband, especially right after giving birth. And so I think her press shop certainly is circling the wagons, and there's not much access and much to kind of glean from them as to how she's feeling at the moment, which I think says a lot.
Well, of course, Karen McDougal, the Playmate model, who said she had a substantial relationship with Trump, with whom she said she was in love. She had an interview recently also with Anderson Cooper, this time on CNN, not 60 Minutes, where she said, where she was asked about how did she feel about having an affair when Melania had just given birth to the son back in 2006. And she said she was sorry, and I'm sorry, I wouldn't want that done to me. The only reference that I recall from the interview last night in 60 Minutes with Stormy Daniels was early in the interview. She sort of said that Trump told her that Melania wasn't a problem because they sleep in separate bedrooms, implying that somehow the marriage wasn't as robust as...
Mm-hmm.
What did you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think they do live separate lives, and I think a lot of these high-profile marriages are hard to understand. I think the Obamas were uniquely kind of down-to-earth in some ways, but, I mean, if you look at the Clintons, that was a very difficult relationship still for people to understand. But I also would say about the Trump son, Barron, you know, he's 11 years old, but he looks like he's a lot older. He's very tall. He's as tall as his mother, who is a model. So I think people think he's older than he is. So I think there is a sense of really trying to give him some privacy and a sense of normalcy, which, of course, is really impossible because of who his father is.
But I mean, if you ask the White House, they're very very upset about anything that kind of gets into the territory of Barron and how he's handling this and what's going on at school. And I think there is a concern that, you know, other kids in his school are knowing about this, and, you know, is he being bullied, and questions like that have come up. So it's a really tough time for Melania Trump, and I think you see that every day in how she's not coming to his defense.
And again, Kate Anderson-Brower, you, in your article at CNN, What Melania Now Has in Common with Hillary, you say Melania now shares the dubious distinction of being a publicly scorned first lady with one other woman, her husband's 2016 rival for the presidency and sworn enemy, former first lady Hillary Clinton. There's certainly some irony there, isn't there?
There is. It's incredible. And, you know, there was an interview that Melania did ahead of the election on Fox, and she talked about having a very thick skin. And I remember hearing that interview and thinking, it did remind me a little bit of Hillary Clinton. And you see that now. I mean, these are two women with incredibly thick skin. And, you know, Hillary Clinton obviously had the ability to weather the storm because she was the wife of the governor of Arkansas. So she had been in the public eye for so long. Melania Trump was just kind of thrust into this. She didn't want him to necessarily run. She is not happy, seemingly, as first lady. She did feel a lot of pressure, I've been told, to live up to the expectations people had for her. She didn't grow up in the United States, so I think it's a title and a role that's very unfamiliar to her. So I think people need to be sympathetic to that, but at the same time, she knew who she was marrying, and she is not dumb by any means. So I'm not sure that she's surprised by these revelations, but I think she's probably humiliated by them at the same time.
So there is, of course, a tradition of infidelity, if you will, in the White House. I don't know how far we need to go back, but let's go back to FDR. Of course, he was very close. He had, I think, a number of mistresses, Lucy Mercer being the most prominent and long-serving, if you will. I was interested in your article. I didn't know this, that Bill Clinton's assignation with Monica Lewinsky, that she had said to – she refers to Clinton, her code name for Clinton was Handsome. And she wrote about FDR and Lucy Mercer and said, "Oh, and Handsome," meaning Clinton. "Remember, FDR would never have turned down a visit with Lucy Mercer." I guess
she knew a lot about American politics. That's
there you go.
And history.
And, yeah, that was one way of appealing to Bill Clinton's sense of history, right? So, and then, of course, Jack Kennedy was notorious. He had the two women. At least he put them on the National Security Council, fiddle and faddle. He swam with him in the yeah. White House pool. So, but something happened. People say it was Gary Hart that changed things by taunting the press into looking into his private life, and lo and behold, all that monkey business came out. Now it's what is it? It's with cable news and polarized information in this country. It's all. I mean, it's all scandal, really. I mean, that's it seems to be.
I think it's true. Well, I mean, I think it's true that also the press isn't willing to overlook some of those things anymore. I mean, I think part of it might have to do with the fact that there are more women in the press, too. And I think that, you know, there's a sense that personal morality and your leadership style and your ethics are all kind of intertwined. And a lot of people would say that's not fair and it's not true. You could be a great president like FDR and have a lot of personal failings. And so I think it's really complicated, and it is salacious. And of course that gets ratings and clicks. And I think people like to read stories about Stormy Daniels and, you know, Jennifer Flowers before her. But I mean, ultimately it comes down to whether or not you think that matters in terms of whether or not they can lead the country. And so I think a lot of people think it does matter. But I, with Donald Trump, I don't think that most of his diehard supporters ever went into it thinking that he was a, you know, altar boy. Like, he's not given that impression to anybody. So You know, he cheated on his first wife with Marla Maples. He's been married 3 times. I with him, it's almost like this is not a surprise, I don't think. And so the question is more about whether what this has to do with the Mueller investigation and kind of the legal ramifications of it, which are way beyond what I can go into. But I think that's what makes it really interesting.
But we've already made comparisons, if you will, with Melania and problems with the women coming forward and Bill Clinton. And now Bill Clinton was impeached, and I recall at the time there was a great deal of moralism from those, particularly in the House, that impeached him, and then in the Senate where they failed to convict him. What happened to all that moralism now? Because Trump is so in your face with all women coming out of the, 19 other women have also claimed either, sexual harassment or you know, something worse, along with, of course, the famous Access Hollywood tape, which is pretty unimpeachable.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is hypocritical, absolutely. I think if you talk to Republican members of Congress, you know, this is the hand they've been dealt, and this is what they have to deal with, and they want to kind of work to get their own legislation passed and work with the president, even if they don't agree with him on, you know, moral issues. And so, of course, it's very hypocritical, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to believe how hypocritical it is. So, yes. And I think also another point I would make just about Hillary Clinton and Melania Trump is that these are two women dealt similar hands with husbands, I think, who in a personal way have betrayed them publicly. But Hillary Clinton came out and, you know, went on the Today Show and talked about the right wing, you know, vast right wing conspiracy. And Melania Trump is not doing any of that. So the fact that she's not publicly defending her husband actually makes her a little more interesting. I mean, I think she's clearly upset with him. And maybe that speaks to the idea that their marriage was deeper than many people think. I mean, if she actually finds this to be a betrayal that really upsets her, I mean, there might be more to their marriage than we know and than we might presume. I don't know. They're very, very private. It's very hard to get much information about it.
Right, but in the last minute, there may be less to their marriage, too. I mean, half of the marriages in this country end in divorce. Do you think we'll ever see a divorce in the White House?
Well, he's broken every other rule, so it's certainly possible. He's unprecedented in every other way, so that is possible. But I doubt that would happen before he leaves office. I really do. I think if that happened, it would be after he left Washington, but we'll have to see.
Well, maybe she stitched up with NDAs like all the other women.
Right. I mean, who knows? Who knows what her prenup says? I mean,
right.
You know, that's what would be fascinating to find out. And nobody knows how long she's going to stick with him or whether or not she really loves him. And they have a son together. And who knows? It's so hard to get inside a marriage, right? But we'll have to see.
Well, Kate Anderson-Brower, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kate Anderson-Brower, a CNN contributor and the author of The Residents Inside the Private World of the White House and First Women, The Grace and Power of America's Modern First Ladies. Her latest article at CNN is What Melania Now Has in Common with Hillary. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.